The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. We're heading into the old vault. This episode originally aired April 21st, 2022, and it's part two of our series on the vegetable lamb of Tartary. Dig in.
Sounds delicious.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our series on the vegetable lamb of Tartary, a legendary creature that appeared in medieval and Renaissance European bestiaries and travelogues, such as the Travels of Sir John Mandeville. If you haven't heard part one of this series yet, this is one where you should really go back and check that out first so you'll know what we're talking about today. But if you're rejoining us after last time, a quick refresher on these legends. The idea was that somewhere in Tartary, which is a vast stretch of the Asian mainland, including what is now Central Asia, parts of China, all of Mongolia, and the whole eastern part of Russia, there was said to live a type of zoophyte or plant animal, a creature with both animal and vegetable properties, combining aspects of a sort of bush or shrub with a sheep or a lamb. And some sources, like Sir John Mandeville, describe a plant that grows gourd-like fruits, and when you cut these gourds open, they reveal fully formed lambs inside, tiny little lambs which have flesh and bone and blood. He says, they're real lambs, and I ate one of the lambs, and it was good. Other sources describe something even more fantastical. I think these are usually sources that come a little bit later than Mandeville. They say that there is a plant that grows a fully formed adult lamb or sheep, which is attached to the ground via a plant stem that grows into its stomach. And the lamb can only survive while there is still herbage for it to graze on within the radius of the stem. So the stem is kind of like a tether. And once it eats all of the grass within reach, it starves to death unless it is killed and eaten by wolves or by humans first. And this lamb or sheep is also said to be a real animal in composition, having bones and blood. And in whichever form, this creature is known under many different names, but the most common ones would be like the lamb of Tartary, the Tartar lamb, or the Boromets or the Baromets. Now, toward the end of the last episode, we talked about phylogenetic reasons that you would not expect to actually see an organism like this. So we can be pretty sure without knowing anything else that this did not actually exist, because Of course, plants and animals may have many individual characteristics that are superficially similar, whether for some adapted reason like mimicry or just by chance, converging ecological needs and so forth. But a plant will never actually grow a sheep that has actual muscle, flesh, and bones and blood. So the question is, where did these legends actually come from? And a couple of major explanations have been offered over the centuries. One very good source that I referred to in the last episode, and I'm going to keep talking about in this one, is a book by a 19th century English naturalist named Henry Lee, and it's called The Vegetable Lamb of Tartary. This was published in 1887.
Now, in that Garuba paper that I referenced in the first episode, the author points out that various folks over the years, sort of in the mythic era of the Boromets, ever since at least, you know, the 17th century, during that period where commentators have known that there's no such thing, but have been curious as to why such a thing might have been invented over time, that various folks have chimed in on it and brought up various plant specimens, quote, natural and manipulated to possibly explain it.
Right.
And so one of the possible explanations that has been brought forth was the woolly fern explanation. And this is one of the possible explanations that Carol Rose mentions in passing. And specifically, it was suggested that the fern's rhizome or the root system might be the lamb in question. And this is actually reflected in the scientific name for this species, Sibodium baromets. And it's also known as the golden chicken fern. And I included a picture of this for you, Joe. I actually ended up going to the Atlanta Botanical Garden over the weekend, and I didn't get a chance to ask anybody if they had one of these around, but I kept looking. I was on the lookout for this chicken fern, for this possible explanation for the vegetable lamb of Tartary, but I did not see it.
Yeah, nice furry fern. I mean, it does look an awful lot like fur.
Mm-hmm.
This explanation, I believe, first arose at the end of the 17th century. So as we discussed in the previous part, by this time authors were already skeptical of the zoophyte story, and they started coming up with alternative ways of sourcing the myth. And Henry Lee chronicles this by noting that in 1698, a Sir Hans Sloane offered a presentation to the Royal Society of London of a very strange object. And in his paper, he provides an illustration. Rob, I've attached a copy of this for you to look at, but we can read his illustration and then add anything we want. So I'm going to read from the section of Sloane's paper that Lee quotes here, but I made some abridgments because it was kind of long. So Sloane writes, "The figure represents what is commonly but falsely in India called the Tartarian lamb, sent down from thence by a Mr. Buckley. This was more than a foot long, as big as one's wrist, having 7 protuberances, and towards the end, some foot stalks about 3 or 4 inches long, exactly like the foot stalks of ferns, both without and within. Most part of this was covered with a down of a dark yellowish snuff color, some of it 1/4 inch long. It seemed to be shaped by art to imitate a lamb, the roots or climbing parts being made to resemble the body, and the extant foot stalks the legs. I have been assured by Mr. Brown, who has made very good observations in the East Indies, that he has been told by those who lived in China that this down or hair is used by them for the stopping of blood in fresh wounds, as cobwebs are with us," and I'll come back to that, "and that they have it in so great esteem that few houses are without it. But on trials I have made of it, though I may believe it innocent, yet I am sure it is not infallible." Now, I have several things to say about this. First of all, I suspect Sloane is wrong that the Lamb of Tartary is actually a legend in India or anywhere in Asia, because as far as I can tell, this was a legend in Europe about Asia, not a legend in Asia itself. Like we talked about Engelbert Kampfer in the last episode, who traveled all about Asia. And he certainly went to Persia, but like different parts of Russia and all over. And I think he said that nobody knew what he was talking about when he asked about this.
Right. Yeah. It's like they don't know what it's about. They don't know what I'm talking about when I bring this up. It's just pure invention and a European invention, to be clear.
But the other thing I would add to this, and this is a sidebar, but I couldn't let it go, were cobwebs, as in spider webs, actually used by the English to stop blood flow when somebody had a big cut, they're bleeding profusely, like, oh no, Johnny got brained with an axe, somebody get a bunch of spiders.
Yeah, I had not heard this before, and I feel like it would have come up. I would have at least seen it on Outlander, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I looked this up, and yes, this apparently was a remedy for bleeding in some traditional European medicine. So the source I found on this was a book by Kathleen Stocker called Remedies and Rituals, Folk Medicine in Norway and the New Land, published by the Minnesota Historical Society in 2007. And this comes in a section of the book talking about home remedies of Scandinavian peoples. And she says that in some cases they would cram parts of beehives and wasp nests into their wounds because they believed it would help make the blood clot. And apparently, some of them did the same thing with spider webs. So here's a quote that Stocker includes. Quote, stopping blood with cobwebs was so common that children learned to apply the remedy themselves, says Hilda Kongsberg, born 1899 in Rolvsøy, East Norway. And then this is quoting Kongsberg. When we children were playing, we sometimes fell and got hurt. Even for deep wounds or a badly pinched finger, we would find cobwebs, kingelvev in her dialect. Sprinkling finely shaved sugar in the wound first, we would stuff it with the kingelvev and wrap a rag around it. Soon it would heal. Folks, don't try this at home. I think there may be some hygiene issues here. I would recommend sticking with sterile bandages if at all possible. The other detail also gets me. So it's not just putting, like, cramming spider webs in your wound, but also sugar, shaved sugar.
Yeah, sugar, something sweet, and then also a little spider web, a little bit of that kingelvev.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was wondering if the reasoning is you want the blood to clot, and these are both things that are sticky, sugar and spider webs.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it does go to show that, yeah, I wouldn't see this in Outlander. I should be watching that show Vikings, and then surely somebody's going to stop up a wound with some kingelvev.
Well, as a commentary note on this sidebar, I will also say this just makes me think of regression to the mean. We have a whole episode on that concept if you want to check it out. But as a note of scientific intellectual hygiene, you can't know if a treatment works just by giving it to somebody who's in a bad state and then seeing if they get better, e.g. if a person with a cut stops bleeding, because people often get better on their own. You have to have a control group. You take bleeding people, split them up randomly. Some get spider webs, some get some kind of control. And then you'd have to see if the people with spider webs do better than the control group, not just if somebody with a spider web happens to get better.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, it's like if you... you're having some sort of ailment that's bothering you and you just decide to try some sort of a weird tea and then you end up feeling better. Well, maybe the tea helped, but maybe it didn't. Maybe you just happened to be drinking the weird tea whilst your body was going about its regular healing regime.
Right.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily. as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Anyway, coming all back to Hans Sloane. So Sloane, at the end of the 17th century, this was the year 1698, he believes he has identified the origin of the Boromets legend, and it is this little quadrupedal plant sculpture that is built out of the downy rhizome of a Chinese species of fern. Now, over the following centuries, a few additional specimens of this sort of Chinese plant sculpture were publicized by European collectors and museums, and many authors clearly believed this was indeed the source of the myth. They thought they had cracked it. You'll remember in the last episode, I read that passage from Erasmus Darwin's naturalistic poem, The Botanic Garden, where he writes about the Boromets. The lines were, even round the pole, the flames of love aspire, and icy bosoms feel the secret fire. Cradled in snow and fanned by Arctic air, shines gentle Boromets, thy golden hair. So why does Darwin specify golden hair there when a lot of the older sources said white hair if they said the color at all? Well, Henry Lee in his book believes this is because Darwin is buying into the rhizome theory. So these lamb or dog sculptures had a more golden or tan color because that's the nature of the plant. The fibers coming off of the fern rootstock were not white. They were like golden or tan or brown. So Lee thinks this is not the correct explanation for the origin of the lamb legend, and I think I agree with him. But what's his reasoning? Well, he goes on a long discussion of the known properties of the ferns used to make these sculptures. He says, first of all, it is worth noting that we have no evidence of these sculptures predating the legend. Examples only show up long after the legend was already known. So if there is any link at all, and we don't know that there is, but if there is any link, why not suppose that the legend inspired the fern root sculptures and not the other way around? Furthermore, there are actually only a handful of specimens of these sculptures. So they are a little, you know, quadrupedal animal looking thing. Somebody is clearly made out of this fern rhizome with the stems cut to look like legs of a sheep or a dog or something. Mm-hmm. But are we sure? I mean, so we have like four or five of these maybe in total. Are we sure they were ever widespread enough to have given rise to this story? But then, so these are, I think, the more minor concerns. Lee gets to the really serious objections to this explanation after this. First of all, he says, these ferns do not grow in the land that was then known as Tartary. So Tartary, again, was the more northern part of the Asian mainland at the time. These plants are from the southern part of the Asian mainland. They're from, like, parts of northeastern India, and they're from southern China and, like, I believe the Malaysian Peninsula. So this would have the legend sourcing them in the wrong place. And also, the fern in no way really matches the botanical properties of the plant described in the stories, except that it is downy. So it's said to grow from a seed that is like a gourd or a melon. Ferns are nothing like this. They don't grow from a seed like a gourd or a melon. Furthermore, some of the legends say that these seeds were deliberately planted by the people around, indicating that this plant, whatever it was, if it existed, is used in some kind of agriculture, and these ferns are not like that. Also, what are we to make of the early version of the story, like the one told by Sir John Mandeville, or the person claiming to be Sir John Mandeville, saying that, okay, you take one of these gourds, you cut it open, and then inside the fruit, that's where you find the lamb. That doesn't resemble this fern, you know, animal sculpture in any way. And finally, the color thing. The legends describe the wool of the vegetable lamb as white when they mention the color at all. And the woolly fibers of the fern rhizome are more golden or tan.
Yeah, I mean, you look at actual photographs of this fern, and it looks furry. It looks like Alf hath died and ferns hath sprung from his body, you know. And I'll also add that this illustration you shared with the stems coming up, this is from Philosophical Transactions, an old black and white illustration. These actually, to me anyway, they look kind of like lamb chops, the way that they have them angled. There's this like curvature to them. And you do see that curvature in images of the actual fern, the actual woolly fern. But I only really draw this comparison when I'm thinking about lamb and lamb meat, and I'm looking at these two images. I'm not sure if I saw this in the wild, I would think, whoa, this is totally the body of a dead brown sheep.
Yeah, if it were the lamb chops thing, obviously, like you're saying, that would have to be subliminal, because I think these foot stalks here are supposed to be the legs of the lamb, like the downy part. The rhizome is the body, and then the stalks coming off of it are the legs. But yeah, they do look like the bones poking out of a rack of lamb.
Yeah,
after the so-called Frenching is done to the bones, to use a ship's term.
but certainly the whole thing with if you cut into the rhizome, you're not going to find blood, you're not going to find bones and so forth. So
right.
Yeah, that doesn't hold up at all.
So anyway, Lee summarizes by saying, even if I had no better explanation to offer, I should be led to the conclusion that the identification of these tawny toy dogs made in China from the root of a wild fern, the spores of which are as small as dust, with the vegetable lambs of Scythia, that being another name used for this region known as Tartary, you know, the Central Asian kind of region, whose white fleeces were found within the ripe and opening fruit of a cultivated plant raised from a large seed, was obviously erroneous, and that the origin of the rumor must be sought for elsewhere. And you know what? I'm going to say I agree. But Lee has another explanation, and I think he offers some pretty compelling evidence that this is the right one. The other explanation is that the Lamb of Tartary legend originates from a confused string of misinterpretations of observations of the cotton plant.
That's right, because what do we have with cotton? Well, we have pods ripening and opening to reveal wool, essentially, or something very similar to wool. And this lines up very closely, with what we see in the myth as well. Lee throws this back to the writings of Herodotus and Theophrastus, whose writings do seem to describe something like cotton. Herodotus, writing in the 5th century BCE on a plant found in India, says, quote, "And further, there are trees which grow wild there, the fruit of which is a wool exceeding in beauty and goodness that of sheep. The natives make their clothes of this tree wool."
Right. Okay. So this is a mysterious plant to Herodotus, because he comes from, he comes from a culture in which cotton is not normally known. So he says, I've read reports that something's going on in India where they can grow sheep's wool out of fruits on trees. I don't know how they do that, but it's really good wool. Another quote from Herodotus, this is in chapter 47 of the same work. He tells a story about a corselet that was sent as a gift by King Amos II of Egypt to Sparta, and he says that it was, quote, "ornamented with gold and fleeces from the trees." Mm. And in Lee's explanation, this probably means it was padded with cotton that had been acquired from the cotton plant, fleeces from the trees. Lee also cites the ancient Greek writer Ctesias, that's usually spelled C-T-E-S-I-A-S, quote, Ctesias also, who was the contemporary of Herodotus and was made prisoner and kept by the king of Persia as his court physician for 17 years, was acquainted with the use of a kind of wool, the produce of trees, for spinning and weaving amongst the natives of India. For he mentions in his Indica a fragment quoted by Photius, quote, tree garments, and that he thus referred to clothing made from these tree fleeces, we have testimony of Varro. Quote, Ctesias says that there are in India trees that bear wool. And also one of Alexander the Great's military commanders named Nearchus apparently spoke with wonder about trees in India that somehow bore wool like sheep, which was of a surpassing whiteness.
Theophrastus, on the other hand, shares the following about the island of Tylos in the Persian Gulf. Quote, wool-bearing trees which grow there abundantly have leaves like the vine but smaller. They bear no fruit, but the pod containing the wool is about the size of an apple while it is closed, and when it is ripe it opens. The wool is then gathered from it and woven into clothes of various qualities, some inferior, but others of great value. And Karuba says that the word Theophrastus uses for apple, melon, is also used for sheep.
Mm. Oh, you can immediately see how that would perhaps cause some confusion.
Yeah.
Now, there's another thing Lee gets into where I feel I need to quote from him directly for his comments on our old friend Pliny the Elder, whom he blames for a literary blunder that introduces one of the main components of the medieval version of the legend. So this is Lee characterizing Pliny. He says, then comes Pliny, who, incompetent and worthless as a naturalist, though admirable as a writer, obscured this subject as he did many others. In his Natural History, he mentions cotton in four different paragraphs and in every one of them inaccurately. He confuses cotton with flax and the fabrics woven of it with linen, and treats of silk as a downy substance scraped from the leaves of trees. And in transcribing or translating the passage from Theophrastus relating to the wool-bearing trees, he distorts the author's words and states that, quote, these trees bear gourds the size of a quince, which burst when ripe and display balls of wool out of which the inhabitants make cloths like valuable linen. Pliny, therefore, seems to have been the author of the gourd portion of the story, which afterwards obtained currency in Western Europe. Okay, so going all the way back to John Mandeville, remember he's writing about the gourdies, the gourds, that Lee makes a pretty compelling case here that this is just a result of Pliny the Elder mistranslating the work of another ancient historian.
Wow.
So, in all kinds of ancient Greek and Roman literature, you have people who are not very familiar or not at all familiar with the cotton plant or with textiles made from it. So you can imagine their confusion if they, say, visit India and see what's being done with cotton there, or if they encounter a garment brought from India, they would be like, huh? So there's a sheep in this tree, or the tree is growing wool somehow? Like, it's kind of like trying to imagine a tree growing meat or giving milk.
Yeah, and kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the last episode. If you're not aware of the actual gulf between the development of mammals and plants, you might encounter something like this and think, well, you know, wool from trees? Well, what else is possible?
Yeah.
But I do really like this theory, and I think it does match up with everything we know about cotton plants as well, because, you know, briefly, accounts of cotton plants goes back, these accounts go back quite a ways, at least to Neolithic sites in what is now India and Pakistan. 5,500 BCE is a date that is frequently given out. Evidence of cotton usage even dates back a good 5,000 years in Mesoamerica, but it wasn't until the late medieval period that cotton became known of in Europe, and its exact origin wasn't understood at first, other than it came from a plant. Here is something like wool, and it comes from a plant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like this theory seems quite sensible. You can imagine how these accounts would have drifted and grown as they were related from individual to individual, from book to book, from language to language, translation and mistranslation in place, etc.
Yeah, Lee argues that the legend arises from embellishment of stories originally based upon ambiguity or confusion in literary sources, and this has two major factors. One, is the misinterpretation of ambiguous or figurative language, and the other is the superficial visual similarity of two completely different objects. And so the direct linguistic example Lee gives is that, okay, what you originally have is reports by people like Herodotus and others of a plant that, quote, bore as its fruit fleeces which surpassed those of lambs in beauty and excellence. And this was soon paraphrased and garbled by other authors as, quote, a plant bearing fruit within which was a little lamb having a fleece of surpassing beauty and excellence. So the fact that there is in India actually a tree with pods that bear wool gets paraphrased, mistranslated, embellished into all these other stories. A plant that's got gourds, that's got lambs in them, or perhaps it merged with the pre-existing weird stories about a ferocious beast who is tied to the ground by a stem that attached to the navel. Well, what if that beast was actually one of these lamb plants or these sheep plants, and that's where the wool comes from? So, even though Lee was writing in the 1880s, I think this etiology of the legend still holds up pretty well. It seems totally plausible to me.
Absolutely.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, originally, I was thinking about getting into related creatures of myth and legend here, and I do, and I think we're going to save exploration of other specimens for later, perhaps. But I do want to read just a quick quote from Jorge Luis Borges in his book of Imaginary Beings. He says, "We might recall another such case, that of the mandrake or mandagora, which screams like a man when it is pulled from the ground. There is also, in one of the circles of hell, that sad forest of suicides from whose, quote, broken splints come words and blood at once. and that tree dreamed by Chesterton, which devoured the birds that nested in its branches, and which put out feathers instead of leaves when springtime came.
Hmm.
That's a great book, by the way, The Book of Imaginary Beings, and he chronicles several different beasts that were dreamed by various writers that he was familiar with, which makes sense. Borges was very interested in dreams as well as creatures and mazes and daggers and so forth. But I think we might be able to come back and do something on the mandrake. I was doing some more reading on that, and I was like, well, this too may have legs and demand its own episode.
Mm.
Now, one thing we sort of teased in the last episode that I wanted to get to as well is the idea of this. Will the vegetable lamb, the vegetable lamb of Tartary, will it ever become a reality? Now, on one level, we have to say, yeah, no matter how like mad science-y or mad science ideas are, I think the idea of, say, genetically engineering a plant that grows a fully bodied sheep is ridiculous. I mean, again, we come back to that gulf between these organisms.
Right. And also, like, why would you do that growing a fully formed lamb that had like a brain and was grazing on the plants around it?
Well, it's mad science, Joe.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. But so assuming you just want to do it for the heck of it, even then I'm skeptical that that'll ever happen.
Well, or alien mad scientists, they just read Pliny and they think this is what's up.
Yeah.
But so we can set that aside, I think. But, you know, it is interesting, though, from a modern perspective, we have to ponder the fact that, okay, we're talking about this vegetable lamb, and well, we are seeing some amazing advancements in recent decades and recent years concerning flesh that feels very much at home in the imagined gardens of Tartary. For starters, there's, of course, the realm of plant-based meat alternatives. Now, the practice of using plant products to simulate meat is, of course, nothing new and can be found in various cultures. Because remember, while modern cuisines are sometimes based on meat for every meal, this is not the sort of thing that traditional societies could necessarily depend on. Certainly, you can find some instances of, say, Arctic cultures that depend quite heavily on meat, but other times, like, meat is something that is a part of a diet that otherwise has a lot of fruits and vegetables in it, and you're not going to necessarily have that meat that's going to be a part of your diet day to day.
Yeah, for a number of reasons. Many of them are economic, yeah.
Yeah. So for starters, I guess we should point out that various fruits and vegetables have long been prized for their meat-like textures, even if they're not being overtly described as such. And I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on these because it becomes more complicated nailing down meat substitute definitions with foods that are not themselves food products. For instance, if you cook an eggplant or a jackfruit the right way, prepare it the right way, you get some strong meat vibes. But I'm not sure we can really classify a culinary process like that as something that can be defined clearly as a meat substitute.
Yeah, and I don't know how often some of these substances that are considered meat substitutes in dishes today, how often they were originally thought of that way.
Like, right.
There's a lot of uses of, say, tofu in Chinese cuisine that seem to me to indicate that it's not being treated as just like, well, here's an alternative to meat. It's a food in its own right. It's just a food like any other food that has its own qualities that are prized. And I feel like I can appreciate it that way. But I know a lot of times Americans might think of tofu as like, okay, this is something you have instead of meat.
Right. And I think with the tofu example, you know, when we're talking about tofu, we're talking about coagulated soy milk. So, you know, it's soybean based, and it's thought to date back about 2,000 years to China. And so you have something that, you know, even if you're definitely classifying it as a meat substitute, it doesn't mean that it's going to be in a dish that's devoid of meat. Right. You look at a lot of traditional Chinese dishes, and they have a lot of ingredients, and sometimes there may be a little bit of meat in there. If you had meat, you might throw it in just because it's going to add to the flavor and all, but it's not, you know, it's not going to be a big old chunk of meat out there on the plate. We get into this a bit in our invention episode on chopsticks and chopsticks were so well utilized, at least for various Chinese cuisines within a large portion of Chinese history.
I think I've gone on record on the show before about my love of mapo tofu. It's one of my favorite dishes, but yeah, most of the time there's going to be some kind of meat in it. So if you're like a vegetarian, check beforehand.
Tofu, of course, can be super delicious. I just had some last night. It had been marinated, and then it had also been battered, and then it was fried up. It was super good. Had it on buns like a burger.
Mm.
Now, some other of the main meat substitutes out there, we of course have seitan. That is the gluten-based meat alternative that dates back probably to 6th century China. We have tempeh. This is a fermented soybean cake. And while the details of its origin seem to be subject to debate, it seems to have originated in Indonesia, but the time period varies from centuries ago to thousands of years ago. And I'm not sure exactly what the predominant theory is there.
Mm.
In Chinese traditions, we also have mock duck. This is a fake duck meat that's another gluten-based product that I believe dates back to medieval China. Have you had mock duck before, Joe?
I have not.
It can be quite good. I've had it before where I was like, this is great. I look forward to having more of it. And I've had it before, too, where I'm like, I'm not so certain about this mock duck. I have had it before where it's really good.
Yeah.
You can frequently purchase it. I've never prepared anything with it myself, but you can get it like in cans.
Hmm.
So suffice to say, yes, you can. You know, we've long known that you can take plants and things derived from plants, and you can make things that scratch your itch for actually consuming meat. But of course, today we have a number of more technologically advanced examples. You know, we have artificial plant-based meats such as, Beyond Meat. That's a company that makes beef, pork, and poultry substitutes. You have Impossible Meat that I think is mostly known for the Impossible Burger. Beyond Meat, I've read, is based on pea protein, rice protein, mung bean protein, and various other plant products, including red beet juice, which is interesting to give it that kind of bloody consistency.
Yeah, simulate the myoglobin.
Yeah, and then Impossible Meat is based on the heme molecule, a precursor to hemoglobin, and processing various plant ingredients to replicate it. But then there's this, and those products are fine. I've greatly enjoyed some of these plant-based meat alternatives, especially of late. But then there's this realm beyond, the realm of cultivated or cultured or cell-based meats in which actual animal cells are grown in a lab setting.
Right. So this would be talking about like the cells themselves are animal muscle cells, but they're not growing in an animal's body. They're just growing on some other substrate.
Right. Now, to be clear, they're not growing on plants. I'm not suggesting that. But it's not merely a fact of it resembling meat or tasting like meat. It is meat. It is meat that is grown in like a lab setting, as opposed to growing as part of an organism in a domestic or wild scenario.
I've been reading about this in bits and pieces from years, and always very interested in it. And I hadn't checked in a while to see like what the recent progress on this kind of stuff is.
Well, there seems to be a lot of movement, and there's been a lot of funding that has gone into it. I think some of the big questions are going to be like, okay, how does this actually roll out as a commercial product? At what point do we reach this place in its development where it's truly economically feasible and so forth? And these are concerns with any kind of innovation, right? We've talked about that before on invention. Like, it's one thing to create the thing, but then how does it become affordable and desired, et cetera?
Yeah.
But I was reading about this a little bit, so I was curious what the latest was. And for instance, there's a company in Australia called Val Foods. I was reading about them on The Conversation in an article by Catherine Wynn and Michelle Colgrave. And they're already growing pork, chicken, kangaroo, alpaca, and water buffalo. Now, none of this is commercially available yet, but it gives you a taste of what's possible. I've also read about lion meat being produced in such a manner by a different company. Because I guess the thing is, it's all on the table if the meat is sourced from a lab rather than a farm or the wild.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't even normally think about eating like land carnivore meat.
No, and I can't imagine I'd want to. But I could see, I can see the strategy here. Like the you want to get people interested in the novel aspect of it. You know, someone who might not otherwise, like, why would I go out and have a lab grown hamburger when I can have a hamburger from the wild? But if you offer them a lion burger, like, what's their alternative? They're going to go out and they're going to kill their own lion. They're going to get lion meat on the black market.
Interesting.
And there, it does seem like there are a number of different Australian companies that are involved in this too. So companies like this are using some of the same biomanufacturing technologies that have been used in the pharmaceutical industry for years. And again, they've garnered a lot of investment, especially in recent years. And some of the outlying questions, you know, come down to just how economically feasible does this become? Does it become desirable by the population at large in the same way that plant-based meats seem to be becoming? So
how fast can you grow like large masses of meat from these starting cell cultures?
Yeah, exactly. As for the taste, I have to stress, I have not tried any of these myself. I have not had the opportunity to, but accounts I've read by such as documentarian Liz Marshall, who did a documentary titled "Meat: The Future," with meat spelled like meat. You know, she says that it is meat and it tastes like meat. So it's not particularly surprising. I've seen some other people weighing in where like, okay, maybe you can get into questions of texture. But for the most part, like it's meat. It tastes like meat.
One of the things I read about, this would have been many years ago now, but like some early prototypes of this were people trying to make a lab-grown burger. And one of the main comments was that, like, in many ways it tasted right, but it didn't have – the fat content wasn't quite right yet. Though I think that's the kind of thing that seems like that'd be pretty easy to get around.
Yeah. Now, as far as actual lamb and sheep meat goes, because we are talking about the vegetable lamb of Tartary after all, lamb is a mammal meat that many find quite delicious. And I have to say, back when I ate mammal meat, I was really partial to a particular lamb tagine stew. So definitely it can be super delicious. And it's an animal that has a fairly large carbon footprint. So if you could find a way to produce that meat without, you know, having to have the same environmental impact, then that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And so at first I was looking around and I wasn't finding anything, and I was like, okay, maybe the age of the vegetable lamb of Tartary coming more to fruition is, we're just not there yet. But as reported by Jennifer Marston on The Spoon, that's thespoon.tech, which is like a really cool looking like news blog about food technologies. According to Marston here, in 2021, the Australian cultivated meat company Magic Valley dubbed itself, quote, the world's first cultured lamb company. So they're saying, this is it. We are going to be the ones that grow the sheep. She also writes that while lamb consumption in the United States has been down in recent years, there's still a big market for it in many countries. So it makes sense for a company like this to stake their claim to the lab-grown lamb meat of the future. Though, again, I have not actually tried any of these cultured or cultivated meats, but I would love to have the opportunity to do so. I find this research very exciting. I think there's still a lot of questions about like where we'll ultimately get to with these technologies, but I mean, there's a lot of movement behind them, so I'm excited to see where it goes.
I agree. It is very exciting. Oh, one kind of wants to be the John Mandeville of the future that says, I ate one of the lambs and it was delicious, except this lamb was grown in a lab instead of inside a gourd.
Now, one thing I wonder about, okay, so we see that they're already thinking about what are all the exotic animals of the natural world that people might wish to eat that they normally wouldn't have access to. Will we go a step beyond? Will we see chimeras emerge? Oh. Will you be able to buy, say, manticore meat?
Will you be able to eat dinosaur meat?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess you already do if you eat chicken, but...
It's true. People are having their dino nuggies regularly already. But yeah, what else is possible? Woolly mammoth steak?
Ooh, wow. Hmm. So somehow I imagine that'd be quite gamey. Anyway, should we wrap up there?
Yeah, let's go ahead and call it for this episode. But there's a lot we could continue to discuss just in like the related realm of, you know, things like the mandrake. But then also we could easily go back to our previous discussion about plant intelligence, plant memory, plant communication, and explore this topic more. So in the meantime, we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Would you like to hear more on this matter or related matters? Is there a particular direction you would like to see us go in? Just write in and let us know. In the meantime, you can listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. In the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, we have our core episodes there on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Mondays, a short form artifact or monster fact on Wednesday, and on Friday we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most important matters and just focus on a weird film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.